It's the Dearly Departed Podcast, featuring your host, historian Scott Michaels, and filmmaker Mike Dorsey.
And welcome to episode 8 of the Dearly Departed Podcast. I'm Mike Dorsey.
And I'm Scott Michaels.
And today we are talking about men who kill women.
Men who kill women and the women who love them.
Yes. This is a double feature. We are doing Robert Blake and Phil Spector.
And the women involved with them.
Various just, ways.
Yeah, just a pair of lovely ladies that their personalities are almost as fascinating as their predators.
Sure.
And I'm looking forward to delving into it.
Me too.
That's what she said. That's what he said. Yeah.
Something. Worked. I don't know. Sure.
Yeah.
Before we get into all that, though, here is hate mail.
Hate mail.
Hate mail.
Scott, what'd you get?
You know what? We got suck mail, Mike.
Oh, what do you mean by suck mail?
Suck mail. Well, you know, I've got some really nice emails from people saying, you know, in the subject line, hate mail. And then I open them up and they go, not kidding. Just kidding.
Made you look.
Yeah, but we really like the podcast. It's like really cool to hear that. So thank you very much for you guys that are listening.
I like that faux hate mail. That's good.
It's almost disappointing, I got to say. But the suck mail we got, a guy by the name of Harry, who's a friend of mine, who lives in Escondido.
And sent I see us, you have an envelope.
Sent us a packet of metal straws.
Yes. Because you're always raging against the plastic straw ban.
You know, plastic straws, for those of you that live in real places, are illegal now.
With real problems.
Is it in California?
I don't know if it's California or just LA County or something
County.
Like that.
Yeah. So we are no longer allowed to get plastic straws from bars and restaurants.
Because it's bad for the sea life.
You have to request them. Mm-hmm. So everyone's buying these. I have one on my keychain that I carry with me because I'll be, you know, if you do ask for a straw, because they do have to give you one for the time being, they give you paper straws. And to me, that's like, it's like putting a piece of cloth
it's
in
funny because a few decades ago, people in LA carried straws around for completely different reason.
That's true. They're a lot shorter, too. Yeah. McDonald's straws were the best.
Were they?
And they still are.
Yeah, sure.
But, I mean, as far as quality goes. But, yeah, metal straws from Harry. And that's really kind of you because getting gifts is pretty awesome.
And they're really cool. They're like kind of the stainless steel tubes, and one of them is bent, or a few
of them
are bent.
And ribbed for your pleasure.
if you like your straws crooked,
yeah,
there you go.
A little curve.
No, they're cool. They're really cool. Thank you so much. I will definitely use mine.
Thanks, Harry.
I had a weird hate mail experience, and unrelated to this story. A few weeks ago, I posted a thing on Twitter. I'm active on Twitter, and it wasn't political in any way. It wasn't an attack on any politician. It was more just about society in general. And it ended up getting like 5,000 likes.
Whoa.
And hundreds of shares. And I was like, oh, that's kind of neat. And then like a day or two later, I woke up and people had found me on Facebook and sent me hate mail.
What did you do?
I won't bore people with the details of what I tweeted, but it was just just commentary about society. And one person wrote, you're just an asshole film producer, which I was kind of like, thanks. Like,
okay.
I worked a couple of decades to get there, so yeah. I'll take the title.
You earned it.
Yeah. Producer title is not something they give to just anybody, Scott. Okay. Now, if you said I'm an asshole film associate producer, I might have been a little pissed off.
Yeah.
But full producer, I'll take. And then this other lady just wrote, sad, sir, sad. No punctuation, nothing. I don't know if she was agreeing with me or disagreeing with me, but I thought it was weird that they found me. And both of them, it included a screenshot of my tweet. And what I had tweeted in response to, but it was the same screenshot. So I was like, okay, somebody took my tweet, and screenshotted it, and put it on a forum somewhere, and now the nuts are finding me on other social media accounts and sending me hate mail. So I was like, I'll probably never know where that was posted. But then a friend on a Tupac message board that I post on sometimes, because I did a documentary called Murder Rap on their murders.
A very good documentary.
Thank
Murder
you
rap.
Very much, Ching. Murder Rap. Yep. Cha-ching! out now on iTunes and all platforms. He sent me a user on this Tupac message board sent me a message just saying, hey, it was really cool that you went viral on Reddit. And I was like, oh, it was Reddit. And he had included a link, and I went. And that's where somebody had taken the screenshot and just posted it to Reddit. And it ended up getting almost 80,000 upvotes.
No shit.
And it spawned over 3,000 comments. And our friend Kelly's a friend texted her that I don't know, saying, is this your mic? And it was the screenshot. And she goes, yeah. And he goes, my friends on Facebook were quoting him.
Oh, my God.
So for like 48 hours, I started a movement. And then it was over.
A movement. Wow. Well, you know what?
So
people
it's weird.
Are fucking weird. I mean, what do they do? They're researching you. They're taking screen captures and they're finding you on other social media platforms.
That was weird because I was like, there's probably 1,000 Mike Dorseys on Facebook.
That's
and they
bizarre.
Found the right one just so they could send me a message.
Don't people have time on there to do other things? I mean, what is that?
And you changed my mind zero.
Yeah,
amount.
Right?
So.
Yeah. Oh, right. Okay. Because you're an asshole film producer. You're an asshole commenter. You know? I mean, there's nothing wrong with having opinions.
Hey, that's asshole podcaster to you, buddy.
There's nothing wrong with opinions, but my God, you know, keep them to yourself. Is
well,
it really?
And he looked up what my title was. Like, he looked up my work history to know, like, what my job is.
People are unhinged. It's outrageous. Mm-hmm. It really is. It's getting to the point where I used to enjoy reading comments. And now it's just like ugh.
All right, so that was hate mail, I guess.
Yay.
We got straws and weirdos. Mm-hmm. Straws from cool people and comments from weirdos. Okay, let's move on to news of the week.
News of the week.
Which is really kind of news of the month because it's been about 3 weeks since we did our last episode on the Ramones. I know. Time flies.
No
3 weeks.
Well, sorry, you guys. I mean, it's really nice of you. It's nice to get emails saying, when's your next one going to be?
It is
and,
nice.
And appreciate your patience. Cause
keep them wanting more.
Yeah.
Somebody said
gagging
that.
For it.
So, the biggest death since we did our last episode has to be Doris Day.
Oh.
The film icon and dance icon and singing icon. A legit triple threat from the classic Hollywood era.
Yeah.
One of the last ones left. She was 97.
You know, she was one of a kind, most definitely. She had a very, she's just a kind persona. And it wasn't, I don't know if it was one of those people. Yeah, she was a singer, like a big band singer.
Yeah.
And then,
before she was an actress.
Yeah.
She had hit some hits.
And an activist, an animal rights activist, way before it became a thing.
I think Sentimental Journey was like her first big singing hit, and that's before she was in it, because I don't think her movie career started until like the 50s, and Sentimental Journey was the 40s. And yeah, she became an animal rights activist, she said, because when she was younger, her dog got hit in the street, and she saw it, and it died, and she always felt guilty about that, and that just led to a life.
So she opened up a hotel for dogs. She did.
Why,
I mean,
really?
Or a hotel where you can bring your dogs.
How about crosswalks for dogs would have seemed more appropriate.
Okay. Yeah, you know what? You got me thinking about people that buy clothing for dogs, and I guess we shouldn't go there because dog lovers are dog lovers.
Dog lovers are dog lovers, man.
I love dogs.
Yeah, you used to have Decker.
Decker was a great dog.
Mm-hmm.
He was a great dog.
Named after Albert Decker, your favorite death in Hollywood history.
That's true.
You named your dog after a guy who had the most fantastic case of autoerotic asphyxiation in history of the world.
Dearly Departed Volume 1.
Check it out.
I told you when I did, when Anthony Bourdain came on my tour, when I shot an episode.
That was Parts Unknown or the other one?
Layover.
Layover, yeah.
And I didn't know who he was. And it sounds like I'm being condescending or dismissive, and I swear to God I'm not. They contacted me, the Travel Channel, there's this guy and we're going to do a show. I get contacted all the time, you know,
right.
Dating shows and, you know, that sort of stuff. So anyway, I didn't know it was Bourdain, and I'm just going, you know, they want to do it Friday. I can't do it Friday. I said, can you do Saturday? I said, no. I said, maybe I can give you an hour on Sunday.
You're playing hard to get with Anthony Bourdain.
I didn't care. But anyway, it ended up being Anthony Bourdain, and we spent a few hours together, and he was a riot. I mean, he was a lot of fun. But when I was taking him around, and he knew his stuff too, he knew the deaths and scandals stuff, straight out asked me, do you have any autoerotic asphyxiation on the tour?
Oh,
I swear to God, it ended up on the show, I think. But it's like out of nowhere he came up with that, and it's like, oh, I'm not saying, I'm just saying.
And that's how, I mean, he didn't die out of he supposedly died from suicide, from depression.
By his own hand. Death at his own hand with a rope. And, I'm just saying. He did say, I mean, it's like, I'm not making this
right.
up. You know, there's proof out there.
Yeah.
So it's just fascinating.
That is interesting he brought that up.
Yeah. of all things.
Do you want to talk about how Herbert Decker died really quick, since people may not know?
Well, you know what, though? I think, is there a clip on YouTube of this? Do we have that up on YouTube?
It probably is, yes.
Well, Herbert Decker died autoerotic asphyxiation. He died in his bathtub, and it was ruled accidental suicide. And he had, you know, oh my God, where do you start? I mean, he had a horse's bit in his mouth. His hands were tied behind his back. His legs were tied together. In his handcuffed hands, he had a piece of rope that went over the shower head that went around his neck so he could, you know, so he could tighten it and cut off his circulation. He had a vagina and lipstick drawn on his stomach. He had the words slave and cocksucker and make me suck written in lipstick and two hypodermic needles sticking out of his right buttock.
And then he had the word whip too written on him, I think, on his hip, I think, where the hypodermic needles were
whip,
or something
make
like
me
that.
Suck. Maybe, yeah. But anyway, so what people might not know is that when we did Dearly Departed Volume 1, you lived in that building.
I did.
In fact, that's how we met, really.
I saw you driving by on your tour, and you kept stopping in front of my building. I'm like, what the hell happened here?
And then
here's
I showed up on
horrible.
Gold Star events. And I was one of the first to be on Gold Star. I think they only had like 20 listings at that point. But yeah, so you and your mom came and took the tour, and then you reached out to me and said, hey, what do you think about doing this, you know, documentary? And we filmed like, I don't know, about 8 or 9 different stories, and I collected invitations from people to get into their homes, and I just took them all up on it with a camera.
Yep.
And we got into Gene Harlow's last home. What was the other thing?
Jack Cassidy's apartment.
That was
mm-hmm.
pretty cool.
Where he died in a fire.
So, but the fun bit was the Albert Decker thing.
That's the craziest.
Because we're going to film in your apartment because mm-hmm. they're all set up the same. And I remember saying, oh, what, you know, if you talk to the person that's in that apartment.
The real one.
So
yeah.
For the hell of it, we went down there and you guys hid behind
you knocked on the door while we hid down the hall.
I said, we're doing a documentary about the guy that used to live in this apartment. And I was wondering if we can get in. You know, could you let us in and film for a couple of minutes? She said, surprisingly, sure. And then I said, we especially want to see the bathroom.
It's got to be like warning flags everywhere.
She said,
right?
Did somebody die in there? And I said, well, yeah. She goes, oh, okay, come back in 20 minutes. So we went back and we told her on camera what happened.
It's one of the funniest, coolest things I've ever filmed.
Yeah.
And it's one of the first things I ever filmed.
It was a lot of fun.
Her real reaction to that story while you're standing there in the bathroom.
Yeah.
Explaining it and pointing where it happened was really amazing.
In your bathtub, right there.
Right.
That was pretty cool. Yeah. That was a, so anyway, God, how do we get on that one? But
we started on hangings and we ended up there. So I guess it's natural.
Doris Day, Anthony Bourdain, and autoerotic.
The six
and
degrees
Decker,
of you know. Doris Day.
That's right. And the Terry Melcher connection.
Yeah. So her son was Terry Melcher.
Terry Melcher. In fact, the bar in her hotel in Monterey that she has for dogs and mm-hmm. It has a bar called Terry's. It's named after Terry Melcher. And Terry Melcher was Doris Day's son. And Terry Melcher lived in the house on Cielo Drive, was renting the house on
Cielo
Drive.
Where the Manson murders occurred, where Sharon Tate and others were murdered.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
So
eventually.
Terry Melcher lived in that house with Candace Bergen before Sharon and Roman. Now, before Candace Bergen moved in, he lived there with Mark Lindsay from Paul Revere and the Raiders. And all during this time, it was the same furniture. It was rented. The house was rented fully furnished.
Uh-huh.
So in the room where the murders occurred was a piano, a little baby grand piano. So I met Mark Lindsay from Paul Revere and the Raiders, and I asked him about Cielo Drive. And he said, oh, yeah, that piano. Terry and I wrote, we wrote Him or Me and Good Times. Those two songs were written by Mark Lindsay and Terry Melcher in the room on the piano that was sitting there when the murders occurred, probably 10 feet away from it. So it's a weird little nugget of information that Mark Lindsay gave me. And magically, it appeared in the latest trailer for Once Upon a Time in Hollywood.
Oh, I wonder how that happened,
that is
Scott.
Fascinating,
must
isn't
be
it?
A crazy coincidence.
Oh, my God. Mm. Oh, my God. I cannot wait for this movie to come out, and I cannot wait to spill.
I can't wait to be able to talk about the whole situation.
Allegedly
people are going to be
spill.
Allegedly spill. Supposedly, allegedly, reportedly spill. Yes.
It's been a wild ride for over a year, and I can't wait. It's going to be great.
And the reason we're talking about Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, Tarantino's new film, his ninth film, is because it just premiered at Cannes this week, yesterday.
Gosh.
And the full trailer, the first full trailer just came out for it the same day, and apparently it's off the charts super good.
Did you ever have a doubt that it wouldn't be, though? And
right.
I'm not a filmy person. You know, I love movies, and I've never been a huge Tarantino fan. Mm-hmm. You know, I like his stuff. But this one is so magical because it's all about what we do.
Right.
1969, Manson, Sharon Tate, the music.
Hollywood, the films.
Yeah, I mean, the clubs. It's mental watching this thing unfold. And putting those places back like he has is mm-hmm. just off the charts crazy. I mean, I get goosebumps. I honestly got choked up a couple of times when I was out watching the shoots, because it was like, this is so magical, uh-huh. you know, to be a nerd about that time period.
And everybody who lives in Hollywood has saw them out filming this past year. I mean, they were everywhere, and they were transforming streets and buildings and all kinds of stuff. Because yeah. there was no like, we'll just do it, and you know, with CGI later. It was like, no, we're going to put an old classic billboard on the roof of that building. Like,
crazy.
We're going to do it for real, right? Yeah.
And he put buildings back.
He repainted things. Like,
you know, I mean, he yeah. put like the Pandora's box. You mm-hmm. know, he
that crazy mural that was in front on the whole front side of that building. He recreated it.
Yeah, it's still there. That's his poster.
I love it
for the Aquarius. Yeah, it's been a really special watching this thing unfold.
Another big death this past month was Tim Conway of the Carol Burnett Show and others.
Yeah,
one of the great comedic geniuses.
He was pretty darn funny.
Mm-hmm.
He was pretty darn funny. He'd been really ill for a long time.
Right.
I know that. There's been is that conservatorship? Is that what they call it when families are, you know, trying to get some sort of legal control.
He was 85, and I think he may have had some dementia at the end, and he was wheelchair-bound, and he died from normal pressure hydrocephalus.
There you are.
Don't know what that is, but something you get when you're 85, probably.
Like an infection of some sort.
Yeah, he died on May 14th, and, you know, it's kind of been fun to watch some of his better, bigger sketches have gone viral over the years on social media and YouTube. His the dentist sketch that he did.
Oh, yeah.
Which is so great with the painkiller.
Is that the one where Harvey Korman pissed himself?
Yes, he supposedly pissed himself laughing at Tim Conway on stage. And then also there was the outtake with him telling the story about the elephants.
Oh,
another
really
funny one. So this elephant circus performers. So rest in peace, Tim Conway. Peter Mayhew, a.k.a. Chewbacca, passed away on April 30th of a heart attack. He was 74. He was 7'3" tall.
Yeah.
And so, you know, as a result, as he got older, you can imagine hitting your 70s. This is a normal-heighted person to hit your 70s when you're 7'3". He had double knee replacement. He had to have back surgery. He was wheelchair bound a lot of the time, just because, you know, your joints and bones don't work when you're that tall,
right?
That old, you know.
Yeah.
So it's kind of sad. But he had become an American citizen. He'd gotten married.
Did he?
In Texas. Yep.
Didn't know that.
So he was all about America. So rest in peace, Chewie. John Singleton, the great director, I believe the youngest director to ever win an Oscar, and the first, I believe, black director to ever win an Oscar, died of a stroke at the age of 51. Very similar to Luke Perry's situation, only a year younger than Luke Perry. And similar thing, had a stroke and was on, you know, life support for a week or two, and then, you know, there was no activity, and they pulled him off of it.
That's wild. Yeah, that was like on the radio, like play by play.
Right.
You know, they were announcing it. They're going to take him off life support and.
So rest in peace, John Singleton. Peggy Lipton of the Mod Squad and Twin Peaks, and the mother of actress Rashida Jones and ex-wife of music producer Quincy Jones. She had cancer, I think, for a long time.
She was very much younger than Sharon Tate. A lot younger than we talked about her a couple of episodes ago.
Yeah.
How she was like, oh, yeah, Sharon's a lot older than me.
Did she say that? I don't remember that. Oh.
And I looked her up, and she's like 2 months older. But,
oh, really?
Yeah.
Yeah, she died at the age of 72.
Yeah, God bless her. Now, she was, talk about, the, you know, the Mod Squad. I mean, they were, that was a great show. And of course, Twin Peaks. And to have parts in two successful shows is pretty astronomical for an actor to have that kind of success. So,
absolutely.
Good for her. She was beautiful.
Yeah. Jim Fowler, the host of Wild Kingdom Nature Series, passed away from heart disease on May 8th.
A lot of people were really affected by that.
Sammy Shore, co-founder of the Comedy Store in Hollywood, which launched many, many, many major mm-hmm. comic careers, and also the father of Pauly Shore, died on May 8th at 92 in Las Vegas from, he was 92, so he died from being 92.
Yeah.
Natural causes.
Yeah, helped a lot of people.
And then the world was rocked. Absolutely rocked last week with the death of Grumpy Cat at the age of 7 from complications from a urinary tract infection.
Only seven?
Seven.
Cats live to be like 100, don't they?
I know. Well, this he had problems. You know, the reason he had the frowny face, which is what made him famous, was that he had dwarfism and an overbite or an underbite, one or the other, and it caused that kind of weird frowny face that it had. It's funny because his owner said he was actually a happy cat. He would play with strings and things, but he just had a frowny face.
Resting bitch face. I mean, that's really what it is. I mean,
basically, yeah, that's what he had. A
resting cat face.
And
I guess
it started a meme, which started an empire. And supposedly, Grumpy Cat leaves behind an estate worth $100 million.
Shut up.
Now, his owner disputes that amount, but that's what's been reported.
Shut up. So what the fuck am I doing wrong? What the fuck am I doing wrong? I mean, come on. Come on. Oh, man. I
think it's funny because normally it's like with Lagerfeld, right? He leaves his $400 million estate to his dog. This is the exact opposite. This cat left a $100 million estate to his
I can't
owner.
Be that much money. Yeah. It can't be.
It probably isn't quite that much, but I would believe it that it's a lot. Just
okay.
The merchandising, and he did appearances. And
I can't. I just can't.
He appeared in photos with like celebrities, and yeah.
I'm in the wrong business. I swear
we
to God.
We all are, man.
Jesus, what a racket! No, it's not a racket. I mean, it's such. I guess it touches the public's eye or heart. But hey, oh man, cat memes. I guess the internet's famous for it.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, there you go. And then an update on a story we talked about on an earlier episode, Keith Flint from Prodigy, his autopsy was revealed.
Mm-hmm.
He had cocaine, alcohol, and codeine in his system when he was found hanging, and they refused to officially rule a suicide. They don't know.
Okay.
If it was accidental, or...
He died
of
his own hand anyway.
Right.
It wasn't somebody
it wasn't
else
foul
didn't do
play.
It.
Right, yeah.
So either accidental... Well, do you think it's pretty determined? Hell...
So
it seems that way, doesn't it?
Yeah.
R.I.P.
Oh, and that reminds me, because he had all the stuff in his system, that then leads me to think about River Phoenix. And there was a story, you know, because this Once Upon a Time in Hollywood is coming out. So Brad Pitt and Leonardo DiCaprio both had stories about brushes with Hollywood deaths. And Leonardo DiCaprio said that the night that River Phoenix died, before River Phoenix went to the Viper Room where he OD'd, DiCaprio says he saw him at a party at a house in Los Feliz, and DiCaprio had never met him before and wanted to, and DiCaprio reached a hand out to shake his hand, and a couple people came between them, and when the people got out of the way, River Phoenix had left, and DiCaprio never saw him again, and literally hours later, an hour later, whenever.
He said that very moment, that very day.
That night,
really?
He saw River Phoenix right before he died.
Do you believe that?
I don't disbelieve it. I kind of can believe it.
Okay, all right.
I mean, I
wasn't there.
It wasn't like I was hanging out with him and saw him fall down on the curb.
I was supposed to be at the house that night.
Yeah, there's that with the,
no,
with the Sharon Tate
no,
thing,
but,
I know.
You know, he's of the same era, the same mm-hmm. time, they ran in the same crowd, so, mm-hmm. You know, it's absolutely plausible.
And Brad Pitt's story was that he had known Brandon Lee, had gone out and partied with him one night,
mm-hmm.
and Brandon Lee supposedly was telling him how he believed he was going to die young. And Brandon Lee died like a year later on a set of
that
of
was
the Crow.
You know that Esquire was a really that article was really good. I don't usually read you know portraits like that, but mm-hmm. that interview with the three of them, Tarantino and Pitt and DiCaprio, was really interesting. I felt like I got something out of it with those people. So I learned something about them, which is not you know mm-hmm. usual.
Okay, so that brings us to the first of our two main features.
It's time for the main feature.
And that is number one with a bullet is Robert Blake. So for people who don't know who Robert Blake was, who was Robert Blake?
Robert Blake. Well, I knew him mostly from the Little Rascals, or I don't know what they call them, our gang now. It was always Little Rascals to me, but he was Mickey. And he was like sort of the cute, dark-haired kid,
mm-hmm.
and a very well likable child star. And then, In Cold Blood was an amazing movie mm-hmm. that he was in, and
based on the Truman Capote book about the murders.
Yes,
yep, the famous murders. Yep.
And then the Clutter Family, and Beretta. I mean, he talk about another one, like a triple header. He did three. Pretty successful things in his life. A memorable film, two memorable television. Or no, the Little Rascals were films, weren't they, when they first started?
Like shorts or whatever. Yeah. And he came along toward the end of that, I think, the end of that run.
He's a fascinating man, really not a very pleasant guy, but understandably so when you read about his past. You know, he had some really pretty wild abuse issues. And he was really good friends with Alfalfa, too, which is kind of interesting to hear him talk about Alfalfa's murder.
Right.
Which would be another one to hit someday.
Gosh, I would love to talk. Yeah, that's a good one.
But Blake, you know, his father was really abusive, nasty man, and did not really resented the attention that Blake got. And according to Blake, you know, the father would walk him around the neighborhood on a leash.
Jesus.
And made him sit in a closet in his own shit, and, you know, just really horrific things.
Wow.
So, you know, the guy was really, really an angry guy, and understandably so when you read about these the level of abuse that he had to endure when he was a kid.
Interesting.
Yeah.
And by the time his case rolled around, the murder that he was accused of, rolled around, he hadn't done anything, or at least hadn't done a film or television in like 10 years.
Yeah.
So his career had kind of dried up. He had aged out or whatever, and he was kind of semi-retired, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of people think that when you're in a hit show that you're rolling in residuals, and, you know, that they usually don't. Nowadays, with DVDs, etc., but you might get more. But back then, you got your straight.
And Beretta was the 70s, right?
Yeah. He probably made like 10 grand an episode in the end.
It's like you put away in savings, because that's all you're going to have. Yeah.
He did have a decent house in North Hollywood, which was nice, and just down the street from the Brady Bunch house.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
So a few years ago, I made a short documentary about a really interesting character in Hollywood. He was an assistant director. His name was Larry Powell. He went by the name Happy, which is the name of the short documentary I made about him. And Larry Powell was a World War II flying ace, and then after the war, he became an assistant director in Hollywood. And he was an assistant director on the Peyton Place series. He was there when Mia Farrow cut all of her hair off.
Wow.
And was in the middle of that whole thing and had to deal with that.
With Sinatra.
He had to deal with Sinatra. Yeah. He used to hang the phone up on Sinatra when Sinatra would call the set. He would say Mia Farrow's acting, and he would hang up on him.
Oh, my God.
Because he goes, whenever Sinatra would call, Mia Farrow would go to her dressing room and wouldn't come out for 2 hours.
Yeah.
And he goes, we had to get through like 15 pages a day. Like, it was a soap show. We didn't have time for her to be gone from the set for that long.
And you talk about Rosemary's Baby.
Yeah. And he said Sinatra would call and say Charlie Brown for Mia Farrow. And that was his code name for himself, apparently. So another story that he told, though, was about working on Beretta. He is as an assistant director. Mm-hmm. And I asked him about Robert Blake, and this is what he said.
In terms of being an actor, Bobby Blake is probably the most professional actor I've ever worked with. He could pull performances out of young kids that he worked with that they never had in them. He was that good. But in terms of being a person, it's pretty hard to describe him because he had some of the most sleazy looking people on a set that I've ever seen in my life.
Wow. Which brings us to... Wow, that's fascinating.
Right?
It's not an isolated incident.
No, it just seems like for whatever reason he kind of attracted these people. I don't know if he was attracted to them or if he was just easily manipulated by these types of people or what the deal was. But I would say that what I've read about Bonnie Lee Bakely is right up that alley.
Yeah, she was
of
she
sleazy
was,
people.
She really was, and it's she was a grifter.
Right.
She was, a user. She was obsessed with celebrities. She stalked people like Dean Martin and Frankie Valli.
She had been arrested multiple times. She used to run personal ads with the kind of nudie photos of herself.
Like sold her dirty panties.
Yep. She would attract, you know, men, and then she would start asking them for money and plane tickets and things. She supposedly had you know, multiple identifications, multiple social security cards. She was just that type of apparently that's just how she got by.
Lonely Hearts magazines. I'd love to know what the names of the magazines were, but putting ads saying, you know, pretty girl wants attention, and then they get a picture of her.
And there are, you know, if you look online, there's a lot of censored naked photos of her that are not exactly professional quality.
Yeah, she was desperate to be famous and desperate to be around famous people. Have you heard the record that she cut?
I don't know. I probably have. But what
oh
was
my God.
It?
It's called Just a Fan, and she was billed herself as Lee Bonney, and it is just like you've heard the Linda McCartney thing,
yes.
Right? It's worse than that. It's straight up. Yeah, it's fascinating. And but she was desperate to be famous, and since she didn't have any talent. She decided to glom onto famous people. So
right.
She was involved with, I don't know, I think it was Chubby Checker was one of them. Jerry Lee Lewis, who she had a kid around that time and claimed it was his. And then he insisted on a paternity test and it turned out not to be his.
Robert Blake, so we'll jump ahead, but Robert Blake was accused of murdering her. She was shot while sitting in his car outside of a restaurant that they just dined at. And he went on Piers Morgan's show in 2012 and had this meltdown. And what he said about her was, nobody ever really knew where Bonnie was. She had 15 ID cards. She had 15 credit cards. She had different places where she lived, and nobody could ever find her if they were looking for her. But one day, somebody opened a paper and said, Bonnie just married Robert Blake. Where does Robert Blake live? And what, a couple weeks later, she was dead. And he goes, I think she was a con artist.
Well, that's clear. We know that she was.
Right.
I mean, he knew it, too, when he was involved with her. She had that baby, and she said it was Christian Brando's baby.
Right.
Because that was another one that she hooked on to.
Mm-hmm.
And then the DNA proved that it was Robert Blake. So he married her, but refused to move in with her. She was living in the guest house.
Wow.
And the only way he'd marry her is that he get custody of the kid, and she only get supervised visits. I mean, you know, she was a piece of work, man. She really was. You talk about sleazy.
So the case was, they went out to this restaurant called Vitello's that I think Robert Blake was a regular at. And they were done, and they went out to the car, and then he went in coincidentally to retrieve his gun that he says he had left inside. So he claims he walked inside, left her alone. When he came back out, she had been shot twice while sitting in the passenger seat of his car. Police later determined that the gun that he had was not the murder weapon. They found the murder weapon in a dumpster a few feet away.
Mm-hmm.
Ultimately, they accused him and his bodyguard of being in part of a conspiracy.
I mean, if somebody else killed her, there's a really fine period of time, you know, between the time that Blake got into mm-hmm. the car with her, said, oops, I forgot my gun, and went in and came back. And, that's,
right.
We're probably talking about 3-4 minutes.
Uh-huh.
And then boom, she's dead. So, all of a sudden they find another gun. And Blake collected guns too.
Mm-hmm.
So they found a German gun in a dumpster. So right. If it was a hit on her, which I'm sure there are a lot of people angry enough with her to
and
want.
And that was kind of what his argument was. And I think what he may have been trying to say was, look, they followed us to the restaurant. They waited for a moment. They saw me go inside and leave her alone. And they walked up and shot her, and I got blamed for it.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know.
Yeah. I don't know either, but she was
I don't know is basically what the jury said, because they both got off and were acquitted.
It's so weird because, you know, just the fact that he found her dead and then he ran over to the house like 20 feet away that he called, you know, they called 911.
He didn't go into the restaurant.
No, no. And it just... You know, she was another one of those convenient deaths, really. A lot of people were really kind of happy when she fell off the face of the earth, because mm-hmm. she made a lot of enemies. And so he was acquitted of the crime, which doesn't mean he wasn't guilty. It just means that they gave a reasonable doubt.
Yeah, they couldn't prove it. Yeah.
Yeah, because she had so many enemies, they had to do was suggest one of the other ones did it.
Right.
They did say that he was responsible, ultimately, in the civil trial, and I think it was like $30 million or something that they awarded her family.
Correct, yeah. They ended up winning the civil suit, and then later on appeal, that was reduced to $15 million, but it didn't really matter because he declared bankruptcy, and he told, he supposedly said, I live in an apartment. I told you I'm broke. I couldn't buy spats for a hummingbird.
People don't even know what spats
are anymore. It's something that goes over your shoes. I think he's trying to say it must be. It's an old fashioned saying.
Well, it's bands and marching bands.
It's probably something he learned on the Rascals.
Yeah. Wow. So spats on a bird.
Spats on a hummingbird.
Because
hummingbirds are tiny. So I think is what he's trying to say. I couldn't even afford spats for the tiniest bird.
Put okay.
On the claws.
That's an interesting.
Apparently,
metaphor,
it's one of his sayings.
Yeah. Okay. So she was. You know, dead anyway. But, you know, did you know that Vitello's had a dish on the menu, a Robert Blake pasta dish?
Oh, really?
And they had the Gary Marshall pasta dish, too. And so their favorite customers, they name dishes for them.
A lot of places do that. Yeah. Like Dan Tana's has a George Clooney one and a Jerry Weintraub one.
Yeah. Interesting. Mm-hmm.
Dish. That's usually what I get when I go to Dan Tana's is the Jerry Wine. It's the veal parmesan.
Oh, yeah.
You know. And Matteo's in Westwood and another Italian place. Yeah. They have a Ray Liotta. Ray Liotta penne or ziti or something like baked ziti, I think.
They got to have a Sinatra dish in there, too.
Yeah, they got his picture on the wall in Mateo's, yeah. And they have, and Tommy Lasorda is apparently a regular there. And
he'll fight for you.
what is that?
That's it. He's that spokesperson for that lawyer on TV.
Oh, okay.
They pull him out to do these spokesperson things. He'll fight for you. Anyway,
that's hilarious.
So, but yeah, so Bonnie dead, and you know, sad. It's sad it happened that for her, but then again, you know, a lot of people were really happy. Jerry Lee Lewis, interesting to note, who was one of her. Wasn't she married like 10 times? And she married
She had ten ex-husbands.
And she married one guy for citizenship, and he got his citizenship, and then she dumped him, and he got deported like a day later.
Yeah, she immediately when she was a modeling or whatever in New York. Yeah,
modeling. And but Jerry Lee Lewis said about her, this is a terrible tragedy for everyone involved. When someone that you know dies like this, it's very difficult to understand. You know, but this is a guy, you know, she sued for paternity and lost. And, you know, what a fascinating woman she was.
And it's interesting that you brought up Brando. Christian Brando, because that was, I believe, one of the kind of alternate theories that Robert Blake's defense tried to say that it was that she was killed by associates of Christian Brando. And for those of you who don't know, Christian Brando was Marlon Brando's son.
Who went to jail for killing his sister's boyfriend.
Yeah, drug problems and stuff, yeah. So he claimed that it was associates of Christian Brando's that had done it or may have done it or something like that, yeah.
You know, what a mess.
Yeah.
What a bunch of scummy people. I'm sorry. You know, I know I'm passing judgment there. I am. I mean, gross, gross people.
It always surprises me when you have all that money and fame and everything and you choose not to go off and do something better with your personal life.
Well, yeah. Or in her case, desperate to have it and in any way, shape, or form. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's just so weird. What a mess.
Yep.
What a gross mess.
And that is the Robert Blake story.
That was great.
And that brings us to a guy who was not as lucky as Robert Blake was, Phil Spector. So for people who don't know, who was Phil Spector?
Oh, my God.
I know. There might be people.
Producer. Guy, my God. The Wall of Sound.
Righteous Brothers. The Ronettes.
The
Be My Baby.
The Beatles.
Let It Be.
What a crazy bunch of... music that he created was responsible for, and what a neurotic individual. But creative people always are. But he was, from early on, you know, very tight with Sonny Bono. Cher got her start singing on, I think her first singing gig was background on Be My Baby. And that's true. That's true.
Oh, wow.
And it just, yeah, they were, you know, he just had a vision. And not many people have a vision that unusual. Like John Phillips did, you know, just such a different sound, just something completely different. And the stuff he did was amazing. And yeah, so he, and Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. What, the Ramones, too. We talked about him a couple weeks ago.
Yeah, he produced End of the Century.
Yeah, and Ike and Tina Turner.
Which supposedly went like $600,000 over budget, and it was just a real... And he pulled a gun on one of the Ramones, supposedly, in the studio.
Oh, he's pulling guns on people.
Which is a theme for this part of the episode. Interestingly, before this incident that we're going to go into here, he, a month before it happened, he... supposedly claimed in an interview, I would say I'm probably relatively insane to an extent. I take medication for schizophrenia, but I wouldn't say I'm schizophrenic. But I have bipolar personality, which is strange. I'm my own worst enemy. I have devils inside that fight me.
Yeah, I could see that. Have you seen that? He did an appearance on the Mike Douglas show. Oh, no, Merv Griffin show. And he just comes off as a dick. I mean, it's just a real, you know, this is the height of Specterism. I mean, he comes out looking like Roman Polanski did when he got married, you know, with the velvet suit and the frilly front of it, whatever you call that. But he just was a total dick during the whole interview. It was painful to watch.
Well, you know, he had this amazing mansion that was built in the 20s in Alhambra.
Yeah.
It's kind of way out there. And he wrote, which is, it's a weird place. We've been to it. It's at the top of this hill, and it's surrounded by working class you know, little bedroom community. Yeah. He said it's a beautiful and enchanting castle in a hick town.
Alhambra is not.
I know, but it's just kind of funny. Like, why would you say that? I mean, that's your neighbors you're talking about. You know what
it's
I mean?
It's far enough away from them, I guess. But you're driving through that neighborhood to get to it. It's really not. You know,
it's a bunch of little houses, you know, kids on bikes and stuff. And then all it's like there's this
little
feudal,
houses, though, like normal people.
Right.
Yeah.
And then at the top of the hill, there's this feudal castle overlooking the peasants. It's really a strange.
It's called the Pyrenees Castle.
Right.
Which I had to look it up, actually, because I know what the fuck it meant. But it's a mountain range from between Spain and France. But
33 rooms.
You know, he had the fame. Well, see, he was living in Beverly Hills first when he was with Ronnie Spector. He moved out to that Alhambra.
He didn't buy that place in Alhambra till the late 90s, supposedly. Yeah.
Yeah. But, gaudy, garish, the usual.
Right.
And insane, like you said. He was on 7 meds at the time. Yeah. You know, he was bananas, but he was consistent with it. And he was, he didn't just pull out a gun that night. He'd done it 1,000 times. Everyone knew it. I mean, he pulled a gun out on John Lennon.
Kind of ironic.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah, right.
Pulled a gun on John Lennon while in the recording studio is usually when it happened.
Yeah. And I think Lennon, didn't he say something like, Phil, if you're going to shoot me, shoot me.
Right.
Don't shoot the ceiling.
Well, he shot the gun off like in his ear, basically, and shot the ceiling. Yeah. The big thing was he had a history of pulling guns on women. And especially in the case of in the late 60s, early 70s, his wife, Ronnie Bennett of the Ronettes, said that she'd been held hostage in their house, basically, and he threatened to kill her if she ever left him. And she ended up escaping in 1972 with the help of her mother.
There's some really good stories
Leonard
about
Cohen
them.
Had a situation, supposedly, where he pulled a gun in the studio. Yeah. In the late 70s, Debbie Harry of Blondie said he pulled a gun on her in his house.
Yeah.
The Ramones again.
Didn't Joan Rivers, I think, said it, too?
It's crazy. And women basically came out of the woodwork and said that he wanted in situations where they were in his home and he wanted a romantic connection and they wanted to leave, he would pull the gun out and say, I'll kill you if you try to leave or something like that.
Oh, which brings us to this.
Exactly.
But there's one that's interesting to note. I remember when the wedding night that he married Ronnie Spector, and he said that she said in her book that he took her downstairs and showed her a casket and showed her a gun and said, if you ever leave me, this is where you're going to end up.
There are accusations that he would bring the gun out in sex situations too. Mm. So like he'd, just had kind of a kinky sexual encounter with a woman and he pulls the gun out. I was like, I could kill you. And it was almost like the gun had become like a turn on for him, I guess. It's really weird. Which again, all brings us to Lana Clarkson.
Where were these, did these women ever press charges? I'm not dismissing what happened to them, but seriously.
I think for most of them, a lot of them were trying to be, were in the business and wanted to be in the business, and he's a powerful, story we've heard a lot of times, he's a powerful person, and they don't want to be blacklisted. They're hanging out with them mainly because they want a shot. They want to get into the business, and so they don't want to report he pulled a gun on me. They just want to get the hell out of there and just never deal with him again, I think is what happens.
Yeah.
It's like with Weinstein. It's the same thing. A lot of those actresses that he went after, they don't want to say anything because they don't want to be blacklisted in the business. They want to have careers. So, they use the power over him. So that brings us to Lana Clarkson. And who was Lana Clarkson?
Well, she was, at the time of this, she was 40 years old. She had already probably ran, the career that she was going to have.
Right.
She was in a Corman flick, the Barbarian Queen, I think is what it was called.
Yeah, and Wizards of the Lost Kingdom 2.
Maybe that's why the sci-fi thing. She had a huge sci-fi following.
Roger Corman called her a wonderful actress with an adventurous spirit. She was also in Amazon Women on the Moon. So I think what happened was she started out with some bit parts in big films. She was in Fast Times at Ridgemont High. She was in Scarface as like an extra.
I don't even think she had a line in Fast Times.
I don't think.
I think that she was like the hot wife of that really
she was Mrs. Somebody,
man.
Yeah.
I don't think she even had a line.
Right. And then she had, she appeared in episodes of Three's Company, Knight Rider, Who's the Boss, The A-Team, Night Court. She kind of had a run on, just appearing in individual episodes of television shows. But then it seems like in the mid-80s, the B-movie stuff kind of started to be the bread and butter.
Did you see her audition reel?
No. Not good.
It's on my YouTube channel. It's fascinating. They show her, you know, barbarian woman thing, and a couple of other things, and then her impression of Little Richard in blackface is.
Oh, I think I did see that. Yes, I've seen screenshots.
Fascinating. It's so bad.
And you'll like this. She played Jane Mansfield, uncredited, in the TV movie about James Dean, starring James Franco, in 2001. According to her IMDb, uncredited as
James Franco did a James Dean movie in 2001.
Yeah, he looked and he nailed it. I mean, he looked like the actor. He did a good job. But yeah, she played Jane Mansfield.
Really?
And who owns Jane Mansfield's car that she died in?
Yeah,
Scott Michaels.
Yeah. Well, no, we own it. That's fascinating. No, I'm processing it because I don't remember that James Franco movie.
And interesting, she was friends with Jack Nicholson, Warren Beatty, Bob Evans, Lou Adler, and coincidentally, she was associates with Robert Blake.
Friends with?
It was described as the articles I read claimed that she was friends with Jack Nicholson, Warren Beatty, Bob Evans, Lou Adler, and then kind of knew or was associates with a few other people, amongst them being Robert Blake.
Friends with?
I don't know. Hung around, saw occasionally, whatever. And there was a crazy story when this whole trial happened where a woman claimed that Lana told her that she was at a party and saw Michael Bay, and Lana Clarkson had been in a couple of commercials that Michael Bay had directed, and she claims that Lana Clarkson walked up to say hi to Michael Bay, and Michael Bay acted like he had no idea who she was.
Right.
And then Michael Bay got pissed and released a statement and even went to court saying, that's, you know, not true. Of course I would have remembered her. I never saw her at any party. What are you talking
about? Well, after she's been murdered, you can't... Yeah. It's almost like you're, you know, you can't say... it sounds pathetic if you deny it at that point, but...
She's hard to miss, though. She was a beautiful 6 foot tall blonde.
There's a lot of them around LA. I mean, I don't mean to be dismissive, but you know, she was, it's like the Playboy Mansion. They were brought around paraded around the Playboy Mansion. They were always like beautiful women in the Playboy Mansion. Blake was a regular fixture there. Bill Cosby was a regular fixture there. So there was a lot of scummy men around, and and Nicholson's famous for partying and having a way with the ladies, and who else? Lou Adler. Who was the other ones that you mentioned?
Lou Adler, Jack Nicholson, Warren Beatty, Bob Evans.
Warren Beatty, not a fussy eater. Robert Evans again, you know.
Jack Nicholson.
Yeah, right.
Who knows?
I think, yeah, right. In retrospect, there's always a lot more going on. But at the time, she was a waitress hostess at the House of Blues. And nothing wrong with that.
So she was murdered.
Yeah.
And the night that she was murdered, and the night started out, it was February 2nd, 2003. It started at 7 p.m. with Spectre leaving his home in Alhambra. He was in a Mercedes S-Class with a driver, and they went to the Grill on the Alley in Beverly Hills, and he had a date at the Grill, and then he drove that date home, then went back to the Grill, picked up another date who was supposedly a waitress in Beverly Hills, who he then took to Dantana's.
Yeah.
And then Dantana's supposedly is where he ordered an alcoholic drink. And if people don't know, Dantana's is a big fixture, a big celebrity fixture in West Hollywood. And it's got one of those bartenders who's been there forever, right?
Mm-hmm.
And the bartender knew Phil. He was a regular and was like, and thought it was a mistake. He said, Phil's been on the wagon for like a year, year and a half, and there's no way he ordered a alcoholic drink. And the bartender actually went over to Phil and asked him, and Phil confirmed, yes, I want a drink. And so he's like, all right. So he mixed it. So he was off the wagon is basically what the bartender said. And so he had a drink there. And then it was a $55 tab, and he left a $500 tip, which was apparently he was known for doing. And it's now past midnight, so now it's February 3rd. And he takes that date home or whatever, and now he goes to the House of Blues, and Rob Halford of Judas Priest was performing, and that's where he runs into Lana. And you have what happened?
Well, okay, so the Foundation Room or Foundation Rooms was the private area at the House of Blues where they had VIP receptions,
and it's a membership only kind of club. I remember,
yeah. And so she was the hostess there, standing at the checking people in or whatever, so making sure they have their membership cards. And she saw Phil Spector come in, and she said, "Excuse me, ma'am, you can't come in here." She thought he was a woman
because he was short and he had the wigs,
the giant wig. Yeah, he always wore bizarre wigs. So ultimately, somebody pulled her aside and said, "That's Phil Spector." You know, so she came over and had him sat down. And at that point, he was alone at that point, right?
Yes.
The second that he time he
now,
got there,
his second date had wrapped up, and he was now alone drinking rum.
I think his driver dropped him off and took the other woman that he was with home, and then came back.
Yeah. And so
that's
now he's
three so far that night.
Yeah, and then supposedly he hit on a different staff lady there at the House of Blues who rejected him, and then Lana Clarkson.
So he met her. She thought he was a woman. And within an hour, she was clocked out and in a car heading to his house in Alhambra.
Right.
So now the driver said that she didn't want to go in the car. And ultimately, he convinced her of it. However, I did the math and I went looking around. The Pyrenees or Pyrenees Castle is 16 miles east of the House of Blues. Her home was 11 miles west
in Venice
of the House of Blues in Venice.
So opposite directions, and that's a long distance in Los Angeles.
Yeah,
you know, that's hours.
So when she says that she, you know, when they say she begrudgingly went home with him and said she'd stay for one drink, there was going to be hours invested in that one
drink.
Maybe
she didn't know where he lived. Maybe she thought, oh, we're just going up to Beverly Hills
possibly.
Or something.
Possibly. Yeah, that makes more sense.
Right, and it's like, holy cow, where are we driving?
Yeah. And they were supposedly watching a movie in the limo. Mm-hmm. Did you hear about that? It was called Kiss Tomorrow Goodbye.
Get the hell out of here. Are you serious?
All research is based on research.
Of course.
So that's just what I came up with. And I found that kind of interesting.
They got there at 3 a.m. and then the incident happened at 5 a.m. 2 hours later. So that's the, you know.
And there were candles and cocktails and, tequila and soda, I think. And
so at just after 5 a.m., Phil Spector comes out of his house holding a gun and confronts his driver who's been waiting out in the driveway and says, I think I just shot her.
Mm-hmm.
And that leads to the police being called and all hell basically breaks loose. And police show up and find her dead on the floor of his foyer.
The driver heard the shots, and first he called Spector's secretary and then ultimately called 911. But yeah, the police had to stage it, and they down below the hill, and eventually went up there and had to tase him.
Because he wouldn't pull his hands out of his pockets.
Yeah, I think
like
50,000 volts or something like that. It was craziness.
And the cop that testified at the trial was basically like, you know, hands are what kill us as police officers. We need to see your hands as long as we see you. And he wouldn't show his hands, so they tased him.
Yeah. So he came out of the house saying, I think I killed somebody. You know, that's basically
the words of an innocent person.
Yeah. So he said,
and later he said she kissed the gun.
Okay. After he got arrested, because he said, I'm sorry, it was something like he did say there was a quote from him just basically saying it was a terrible accident.
Yeah. And she was found on the floor and she'd been shot in the face. She shot in the mouth, basically.
Yeah.
The gun had been in her mouth and went off.
Yeah. And I got something to say about that, too.
Mm-hmm.
But what he said about after that, when he was arrested, and that's when he started getting defensive. And he said, and this is a quote, he said, I don't know what the fucking lady, what her problem is, but she wasn't a security at the House of Blues, and she's a piece of shit. And I don't know what her fucking problem was, but she certainly had no right to come to my fucking castle and blow her fucking head open.
And that ended up becoming the basis of his defense, was he claimed that she committed suicide.
Yeah.
With his gun.
Right.
That she somehow found.
With her fingerprints on the gun. His weren't. I don't remember exactly.
I think they didn't find his fingerprints on the gun, even though he was holding it when he came out of the house, supposedly.
Yeah. No, it was on her. It was on the floor by her feet. That's right.
Well,
there's the picture.
Well, he came out of the house with the gun, though, supposedly, when he told the...
He put it back?
I think he must have gone and put it back.
Okay.
Because that's what the driver said. He was holding the gun and said, I think I shot her.
Okay.
And then went back inside the house. And I think it looked like he kind of tried to clean up a little bit.
He did, because he was wearing a jacket that had blood in it. And also, there was a bloody cloth they found up in the bathroom. And I don't know if he wiped the gun clean. I'm not quite sure. So he basically copped to it and then copped an attitude about it. And yeah, and then that's, he, you know. So that's what happened. So he was charged with the crime. And now here's my take on it. I think that we know that Lana Clarkson was an actress. We know that she used guns. She was she
owned a gun.
Yeah. And she knew how to use a crossbow.
Right.
She knew how to use that. So she was well versed in how guns work. Mm-hmm. And we know Spector was, too. So here's my take on it. Now, take it for what this is, my theory, that Spector's always pulling guns. Now, she was there for 2.5 hours. She was found in the chair, and her purse was over her shoulder. Mm-hmm. So, and she's
in the foyer like she's leaving.
Yeah, right. So I think that he made a pass at her, And I think she rejected him. I think he put the gun in her face. And I think that she took the gun in her hand and put it in her mouth, possibly being some sort of gesture, erratic gesture maybe or something.
And it went off.
And it went off.
Mm-hmm.
And I do think that it certainly was accidental, and I don't think it was suicide. And
no.
But, I mean, Craig, our friend Craig Harvey, who was the coroner at the time, the chief of special investigations, he said, well, she had a gunshot wound in her mouth. Now, people that want to commit suicide will put the gun in their mouth.
Right.
This gun was in her teeth.
It went through her teeth first. Right.
So if she meant it, it would have gone in her mouth and probably up her brain if she'd have thought that far. But instead, her teeth were, you know, blown all over the floor, and she was it just wasn't good enough of a shot to kill herself if she was going to kill herself.
Yeah.
And I do think that she just took that gun in some sort of gesture.
Yep.
And it was a terrible accident. I think that's what, I mean, it just makes sense. Teeth on the ground. Mm-hmm. If you're going to kill yourself, you put the gun in your mouth.
Yeah.
You know,
I definitely don't buy the suicide thing. And I think that it fits his MO.
Yes.
Perfectly. Woman is rejecting his advances. She's trying to leave. He pulls a gun out. And this time, finally, what was inevitably going to happen eventually at some point, mm-hmm. he finally went off and killed the person that he was with. Yeah.
Yeah. So, and he went off the rails with that trial was insane.
Mm-hmm. There were two.
Yeah. Yeah.
So hung jury on trial one and then trial two, they convicted him.
Of those wigs he would show up with. I mean, he had a page boy wig.
He was like fro wigs.
Yeah. Oh, that was to say the Hair Bear Bunch. I mean, look up Hair Bear Bunch. And it's that.
Right. He did say she kissed the gun. So maybe that is, sometimes there's some truth to, you know, a lie. So maybe what you said is what happened. He was convicted of second degree murder in the second trial. He was sentenced to 19 years to life, which means assuming he lives, he'll be 88 years old before he's even eligible for parole. And he has bad health. So he's been in the hospital prison,
mm-hmm.
state hospital prison.
They won't let him wear his wigs.
Yeah. And his mug shots or whatever you want to call it, his booking photos and stuff all show, you know, a bald head.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And he's getting a divorce now, who he married during the trial, mm-hmm. who is considerably younger.
She was like 26.
Yeah. And cut an album, I believe.
Of course she did. Yeah.
I know people that know her, so she's supposed to be a nice person, as far as I've never met her, but they are divorced.
She kind of looks like Lana Clarkson, to be perfectly
Does
honest.
Does she?
The photo I saw, was like, at first I thought it was Lana Clarkson, and then I realized it was
not. Yeah, the type. Earlier. Well, then Ronnie Spector did not fit into that type.
Not at all, no.
But here's something that happened. I'll preface this by saying allegedly, because I think you have to, because I can't remember this conversation verbatim.
Sure.
But this happened to me. Absolutely 100% happened to me, allegedly. I was at Hollywood Cemetery, and I was in the mausoleum where Lana Clarkson is in urned.
Oh,
you
she's
know?
At Hollywood Forever. Okay.
Yeah, she's in that the chapel at the front, and a really cool place that she's buried in. And her mother was there. And it was shortly after he was found guilty, and I said to her, I'm very sorry about your loss, and it's about time that, you know, justice was finally served. And from her mouth to my ears, she said all he had to do was apologize, and this whole thing could have been avoided.
Wow.
There you go. But that's the God's alleged truth.
Huh, the God's alleged truth. Well, so when I first moved to LA, and I think I may have told this story once before, so I'll tell the shorter version of it. But when I first moved to LA, the first job I got on a film was on a micro budget vampire movie that literally was being made on people's credit cards. and the film ended up closing up after like 2 weeks because I guess they ran out of their credit card limit. So we never finished the film. And I remember we were looking for a scream queen to be in this one little bit scene. And I went down to a convention at LAX with the film's producer, and we met Lana Clarkson at sitting at a table, as they do at these conventions. And he gave her the script, and he had a conversation with her about the part.
Wow.
And he claims that she was into it and was like, okay, sure. I mean, it was a part, so why not?
Yeah.
And so, and we parted, and let's follow up, exchanged contact information, whatever. And I didn't know it was Lana Clarkson at the time. I just saw it was a tall, blonde, pretty lady.
Yeah.
She was very nice. She was very sweet.
She was beautiful.
And we walked away, and then I remember either days or weeks went by, and he got mad because she apparently hadn't gotten back to him. And then he calls me in a panic. He goes, I'm at the grocery store. I just checked out and I looked at the tabloids, and that lady that Phil Spector killed is he hadn't been following the news. He goes, that's Lana Clarkson. He goes, that's who we talked to. And he goes, and he's like, oh, the script for the movie is probably in police evidence now because it was probably in her car and whatever, whatever, whatever. But he's like, that's why I never heard back from her, because she got murdered after we met her. So I only know based on his word that that's who that was, but it definitely looked like her from what I remember. And I know she did. I know she did fan conventions and things. Yeah. And I saw that she was in a I looked it up. She was in a thing down by LAX in November of 2002, just a couple months before she died, at a fan thing called GlamourCon. And she was one of the special guests there, so that might have been where we met her at. But I do remember it was a convention down by LAX at one of the hotels down there.
Wow. So how interesting.
Crazy.
It sucks to be her.
I know.
I mean, what a shitty, you know, both of these guys were pieces of work. Mm-hmm. And they came from an era where that was more acceptable than it is today. They're monsters by today's standards. They were eccentrics back, you know, 30, 40,
hounds
50 years ago.
Or whatever you want to call it, right?
Yeah, right. Mm-hmm. So, and this stuff just literally blew up in their faces.
Literally. So the trial was a circus in part because the defense is trying to make this whole suicide theory happen. And so what do they need? They need witnesses to come on and basically trash Lana Clarkson and that she was suicidal and, you know, she was a hooker and all this stuff happened. And this woman, former alleged madam named Baby Doll, who had gone to prison, claimed that Lana Clarkson had been one of her girls under the name Alana, I think, back in the 90s. And the judge made that woman, you know, basically shut up and barred her from talking about anything Lana Clarkson related in public or in trial. And these other women that claimed to be her friends, you know, said that she was, you know, distraught over her career and was suicidal and whatever. And, you know, what's so stupid about that is she owned a gun. If she wanted to kill herself, why would she go to some stranger's house?
Yeah.
What, she went through the house and found his gun and had her purse over her shoulder in the foyer and decided to just randomly shoot herself? I mean, it doesn't make any sense at all.
Yeah, with her newly capped teeth.
Right.
But you know, and it's funny because people were kind of crawling out of the woodwork. But then, so the prosecution was looking for them to crawl out of the woodwork.
Well, the defense team was.
Or the defense, I'm sorry, yes.
And the prosecution were the ones that were discrediting them as, no, these are just...
Yeah.
You know, these are women, you know, women that are trying to sell books or whatever, and they're just looking for fame. Yeah.
I don't think she was suicidal.
No.
I don't think she was a prostitute.
No.
We do know that Phil Spector came in, and she thought he was a woman, and within an hour was on her way home with him.
Yes.
And ended up not leaving that house.
Right.
So what happened during that three-hour period of time, or 2.5-hour period of time? 3 hours, I think.
Right.
There were drinks. There were candles lit. So
I think the other M.O.
But there
was
no semen. There was no sexual activity.
I think the other M.O., though, with Phil Spector is a lot of times women wanted to be around him because they thought it might help their career.
Mm-hmm.
And so maybe that's just what she thought. Oh, this might be a good contact for me to have.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe I'll get some, you know...
Yeah, and what you said, I never put that together, but maybe she just didn't know where he lived.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, I mean, because it's a hell of an error. And, you know, it's, hey, come on to my mansion. You think you're going to be down the street in Beverly Hills.
It's like
and you don't know
45-hour drive out to Alhambra.
yeah. So
it must have been like, where are we going?
Yeah.
Because you have
put on a movie.
Like, why are we on the, why, we just passed downtown Los Angeles. Like, where in the hell are we going? Dominic Dunn wrote a really good article during the trial. He had a lot of trial coverage of this. He claims that in the time after the murder happened, the next 8 days after the murder, that Phil Spector checked into the Hotel Bel Air for 8 days, which is the same hotel that the Menendez brothers moved into after they murdered their parents. Isn't that crazy?
Yeah. Yeah. The Bel Air Hotel, have you ever been there before? It's really nice and really secluded.
I haven't. I've been to the Beverly Hills Hotel. I haven't been to the Bel Air one.
Yeah,
it's
like
even more secluded than Beverly Hills.
It's like in the woods almost, you know, but it's not. And it's really, really beautiful.
I don't know if it's sold, but the Pyrenees Castle was recently listed on the market, his mansion where this all happened, back in March for $5.5 million.
Which isn't. For a house that you pick up that house and put it in Bel Air, you're talking about, you know, easily like
15, 20 million,
easy.
Probably. Yeah.
Yeah. So, I don't know. Fascinating. What an interesting man and a horrible person and always has been. And eventually somebody had to die because of it. But he was a loaded pistol.
He was a gun waiting to go off.
Yes.
Exactly.
The end. Now, this has been fascinating. It really has. You've opened my eyes as far as this Lana Clarkson thing.
Did we miss anything that you wanted to go over, though? Because the stuff, the accusations against her are still salacious and interesting. I mean,
yeah, I don't necessarily, I don't think she was a hooker, but I do think that, like Virginia Graham, who is the woman who I know that was in prison with Susan Atkins, and Susan Atkins confessed to her, and Virginia Graham, it was ultimately her testimony. It was ultimately Virginia Graham who contacted law enforcement and told her about Susan Atkins' confession. And she is called her first book was Joy of Hooking. And then she disowns that project. But her other book, Manson, Sinatra, and Me, she talks about it. And it says, A Life of a Party Girl. And she was friends with Sinatra, and she was a part of the scene. So I said, okay, Virginia, what does party girl mean? She goes, I know what you're thinking. And I said, well, I have to ask, mm-hmm. What is party girl? Is that prostitute? She goes, it wasn't like that. It wasn't like there was a cash transaction. You know, I was nice to men and men were nice to me and they bought me nice things. So, right. there's an element of
more of a sugar daddy, maybe yeah. type of a relationship situation. Yeah.
She was brought into parties and entertained mm-hmm. and was entertained. So I don't know. It's interesting. I'm not saying this is all alleged. Yeah. You know, we can't say we know what she was all about because she's dead, but certain things fit.
Yeah. You can see when you see the both sides, the victim and the killer, how it was a perfect storm situation
yes.
coming together.
Yeah, absolutely. And absolutely. You know, and then the Blake thing, no. Those were like two separate storms
right.
that, that eventually collided. anyway. Well, cool. Then thank you, people. Thank you for tuning in and spending time with us.
So there it is.
Cool.
Thank you.
Thanks, guys.
This has been an episode of the Dearly Departed Podcast. Dig up more episodes at dearlydepartedpod.com and on iTunes and Google Play. See you next time.